Blog Talk Radio.
Crummy spectacles. Welcome to Eerie House Radio. I'm Dale Kay from Spook Show. I am accompanied by...
Not buried treasure, but I am Dave Binkley from Weirdness, Really Bad Movie, and the Spaceship One, and we're here with just ourselves tonight. Yeah,
just ourselves. Yep. I object. You are indeed a treasure, a jewel, a gem.
Yeah. What do you want?
Still won't go out with me, huh? All right, no. Oh, God. Oh, no. Not quite. But we got some radio for you. A whole lot, I would imagine.
A whole lot. Yes, we do. Lots and lots of radio. And we are even going to try and sneak another bit in here for 4th of July as well. So, you know, I'll look forward to keeping rolling. But, yeah, we got a tremendous mystery theater, one that brings back memories for me. And a Yankee Yarns, the second time we've had the Yankee Yarns. So it just...
That's right. We're doing some needlepoint. So we got plenty of yarn. Knit one, purl two. Knit one, purl two. Now, we're continuing in our saga about treasure, buried treasure, other kinds of treasure.
Yep. This mystery theater is one that... one of the many that my brother and I had on cassette, and it was just a good story, and we got to listen to it over and over and over again. And I told you before we went on the air, the one thing that distinguishes this story from any other radio mystery theater is that this is the only story that I know of that aired on both the Radio Mystery Theater and on the Sears/Mutual Radio Theater as well. This is a superior version of the story. I was the same writer, but just the way that Elliot Lewis's Grew handed it, it was still good, but it wasn't as good as what Hyman Brown did with his cast. Of course, Norman Rose and Arnold Moss, those two leading it off, just fantastic. You can't ask for a better cast than that.
We got some goodies for you tonight.
And you know why I love to go through some of the reviews of the stories, the mystery theaters. And I love this one here. It said, this is a fun program to listen to. Treasure, intrigue, suspense, mystery, secrecy, syndicates, pirates, legend. It's all in there and makes a good story. Good acting, surprise ending, enjoy listening. Not a lot more to say in my initial analysis. I shall see what you folks have to say about it.
Yep. We would like your opinion when it's done, if you like. And we'd like to welcome Fogsbane, GGSI Paper, into the chat. Boy, there was hardly any room in here last night.
Yeah, I know. I had to turn the air conditioner on a little extra high, you know. But that's okay. That's okay. It worked out.
Yeah, no, a lot of folks dropped in last night. That was nice. Very nice to see Mike Mace. That was good.
Yeah, he was all packed up for his wife has a big event that she is kind of co-chairing down in Columbus, and so he's had a lot to work through that. And everything was done. And the car was packed up. He said, "I'm tuning into Eerie House Radio." So
great. And
join in the conversation.
Yeah. Gotta love that. So we probably ought to get rolling here. Let's get started with CBS Radio Mystery Theater. We'll save our Yankee Yarns for a little later. And
we will.
This one, The Laughing Maiden, is from?
Originally broadcast January 13th, 1978.
The CBS Radio Mystery Theater presents... Most of us have a healthy love of adventure. We like to do new things and visit strange places. We don't even mind taking certain risks, but within limits, of course. To wager life and limb in pursuit of adventure is only for the very few. And rarer still is that breed of person who insists on venturing forth, even though the outcome is almost certain to be death.
I'm telling you, it's out there, Jason. I have proof now.
It's right there in front of you.
I'm sorry, Ernie, but I'm not going to help you.
In the old days, you were never afraid of risk.
In the old days, I had nothing to lose.
And now you do, is that it? Just what is it you're so anxious to protect?
My life.
Is that it, Jason? Is that really it? Or is there something else?
Our mystery drama, The Laughing Maiden, was written especially for the Mystery Theater by Percy Grainger and stars Norman Rose. It is sponsored in part by True Value Hardware Stores and Buick Motor Division. I'll be back shortly with Act One.
Hello, this is Elizabeth Taylor. I've had the opportunity to play a lot of different women on the screen. It's fun to pretend to be somebody else and to be able to throw off that characterization whenever it suits you. But my real life and yours is one characterization that none of us can cast off when the going gets tough. No matter who you are, the most important thing any one of us can have when we need help is someone else. There's one organization that tries through thousands of agencies and programs to be there when people do need help. It's the United Way. And they don't claim to have all the answers, but with your support, they are there. And they are someone to the people that need them the most. Thanks to you, it works. And for all of us, the United Way.
There are people who thrive on danger, who need to live on the cutting edge of existence, taking risks and meeting challenges which seem unnecessary to everyone but them. Financial reward is of little importance. Just to survive is their triumph. Then there are others, people call them soldiers of fortune, who willingly put their lives into the hazard in hopes of gaining such a prize they will never have to worry again if they live.
My name is Jason Hainsworth. I suppose you'd call me a drifter now, though once I was half owner of a charter fishing boat in the Florida Keys. The story I'm about to tell concerns my former partner, Ernie Chowders. It happened 5 years ago, but I've kept quiet all this time because even now I can't quite believe it. I was in a small town in the Caribbean. I hadn't seen Ernie for several years, and then...
Jason? Jason Hainsworth, is that you?
Hey, Ernie, son of a gun, how are you? What are you doing here?
Oh, hey, I could ask you the same question.
Sir, how are you?
Oh, you know me, nothing changes. You're still hiring out with a Laughing Maiden.
A Laughing Maiden? You still have the boat, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
That old Tom?
Oh, he's still the crew, loyal as ever. A couple of years ago, we had a good season. I was going to get a new boat, and old Tom wouldn't hear of it. Said it would be bad luck to leave a Laughing Maiden.
He's still superstitious, huh?
Oh, sure, sure.
Why are you here in Monte Cristi? There can't be many rich fishermen coming through a little port like this.
Oh, well, it's part of the Caribbean I hadn't seen before, I guess.
But what is it that could possibly attract you to a place like this? There's no tourism that I can see.
Look, how'd you like to come see the boat? Say hi to old Tom, and maybe we'll talk, okay?
You're not in some kind of trouble, are you?
No. No, it's not bad at all. Hey, look, there she is.
Yeah, a Laughing Maiden. Looks like you haven't given her a new coat of paint since I left.
Come on board. Tom! Tom, come up topside.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chowder's lunch ain't quite ready.
Oh, never mind lunch. Look who I got with me.
Oh, Mr. Hainsworth.
How are you, Tom?
Yeah, I guess I'm all right. Just about got to fix some lunch. You gonna stay?
Yeah, of course he is.
Unless he's got some other business.
No, nothing. I'd like to join you.
Well, it's okay.
So, how's the old ship sailing, Tom?
Well, it stays afloat.
I'm gonna walk around some and try to get my sea legs back. It's been a long time.
Yeah, sure. Sure, Jason, you go ahead. Did you tell him, Mr. Chowders?
No, not yet, Tom.
Don't you think you ought to?
I don't think it'll matter. I get the impression his luck's not been too good lately.
Well, it's a fact. I'd sure feel better with another person along. I hope he still carries that pistol.
There he comes.
Well, I'll go down and make lunch, but you tell him, Mr. Chowders, and tell him the whole truth. He's your friend.
This sea air is like a tonic. Ernie.
Huh?
Is there something wrong with Tom?
Tom? No, why?
I don't know. He seems a little on edge.
Oh, you know, Tom, he's always been a little strange. Well, how's the old rig feel?
Oh, she's solid as ever. But she could use some repairs, though, and a new coat of paint. How do you expect to drum up business if she's not looking her best?
Jason, I got a confession to make. Tom and I, we aren't in the chartering business anymore.
Well, then, hey, Ernie, you're not into anything illegal, are you?
No, no, nothing like that. You ever hear of Cape Coast Island?
Oh, sure. It's on the tail end of the Bahamas.
Yeah, it's across 100 miles of open water due north of here.
Mm.
Did you ever hear of the Quedog Merchant?
Quedog Merchant? No.
Well, how about Captain Kidd?
Oh, Captain Kidd.
Jason, the Quedog Merchant was a ship that was captured by Captain Kidd nearly three centuries ago. On board that ship, he found what was reputed to be the single richest prize ever taken by a pirate of the Spanish Main. 60 pounds of gold dust, 100 ingots of pure silver, jewels. Well, the whole cargo was valued at 10,000 pounds then. You know what it'd be worth now?
And this treasure is supposedly buried on Caicos Island.
Not supposedly. It is, I'm sure of it. Kidd buried it there before returning to New York to face charges of piracy. He intended to return for it, but he never did because he was arrested and sent to England to stand trial. He was found guilty and executed.
Ernie, they claim there's treasure buried on half the islands in the Caribbean. What makes Caicos so special?
Well, about a year ago, this guy chartered the Laughing Maiden. In addition to being a fisherman, he was also an amateur treasure hunter. He told me the whole story, and he paid me to take him out to Caicos to nose around.
So you want me to come out and help you dig up the island looking for this treasure?
No. The place is too big for that. What we've got to do is find the rock.
What rock?
According to the story, after Kidd buried the treasure, he carved the directions to it on a rock. Oh, if we can find that rock, Jason, we're rich.
And this is why the Laughing Maiden needs a new coat of paint?
We've been out to Caicos a dozen times. I've been making a methodical search, taking one section of shoreline at a time. Jason, today could be it. There's only one small strip of beach on the leeward side I still haven't explored. So what do you say?
Now, this isn't one of those treasures that's guarded by some pirate ghost, is it?
Oh, don't be silly. Let me show you something. Yeah.
What is it?
It's a Spanish doubloon. Pure silver. I found it on Caicos the day that amateur treasure hunter had me take him there.
Look, there's bits and pieces of booty all over the place down here. You can hardly scratch the ground without...
But this is from the Quedog Merchant. I have proof of that.
How?
Look here. See the imprint?
Mm.
You see these numbers down at the bottom? They're a code for the place where the coin was minted. Toledo, Spain.
Mm. Well, how do you know it was Toledo?
Because I wrote to the National Archives in Madrid and asked for a copy of the Quedog Merchant's manifest. And there it was. The numbers on the manifest matched this coin. Oh, so no doubt this coin came from that ship. So, what do you say? We'll cut you in as an equal partner. An even three-way split.
Why?
For old time's sake. We were partners once before.
We'll be partners again.
I'll come along, Ernie. But just for the ride, you hear me? Just for the ride.
I always time it so we arrive at low tide. That way we can cover the whole beach.
Well, the whole beach is solid rock. No wonder the treasure's safe.
Yeah, we only got to cover up to that spit there.
You mean to tell me that you've been all around this island?
Yeah. That rock's here. I'm going to find it.
What about Tom?
What about him?
How come he stays on the Laughing Maiden? Wouldn't it go faster if he helped you?
Oh. Well, Tom's kind of a lookout.
Oh, a lookout, huh? What for? What's that?
It's Tom. We gotta get back to the Laughing Maiden quickly. It's incredible. I don't believe it. How could they have known?
How could who have known?
The syndicate.
What syndicate?
Did Mr. Chowder's tell you?
No, but I think that it is time he did. Ernie, are we in danger?
I never thought they'd find us. That's why we moved up to Monte Cristi. They must have spies everywhere.
Tom, will you tell me what's going on?
Here's the binoculars, Mr. Hainsworth. You just see for yourself.
Let me look. Hey, looks like the mast of a ship.
Well, it's a yacht. A big yacht. High speed and heavily armed.
Well, who owns it?
Well, there's a syndicate. It's rumored to be headquartered in Puerto Plata, but no one knows for certain.
Well, who's the head of it?
No one knows, but whoever it is, he knows the legend of Cacus Island, and every boat that comes out here is followed by that yacht. It sits right over there just behind the horizon. And if the treasure is ever found...
Now they sweep down, seize it, and probably kill whoever had the misfortune to discover it. So that is why you were so anxious to cut me in.
No,
you tricked me. You tricked me into coming out here. Start the engines. I want to get away from here at once. I left Monte Cristi that evening. Didn't see Ernie or Tom again for some time. And then several months later, I happened to be passing through the village again on my way back to the States. I was still upset with Ernie and had resolved not to visit the Laughing Maiden. But I did linger in the town for several days. Why I stayed, I don't know. Nor to this day could I tell you if it was a mistake or a blessing in disguise.
Mr. Hainsworth.
Oh, Tom, how are you?
When did you come into town?
Well, I've been here for a while.
You weren't going to come down to the Laughing Maiden?
I don't think so, Tom.
Well, I can't say I blame you much. Wasn't right of Mr. Childers not to tell you the full story.
We might have been killed out there. Although I hope you haven't gone back.
No.
Good. That means Ernie has finally given it up, huh?
Mr. Hainsworth, I wouldn't blame you if you said no. Not after what happened, but I think you better go to see Mr. Chowders.
Why?
I'm worried about him. Real worried. He's in a bad way. He's hardly left the boat for the past 3 months.
What's happened?
Well, I'd rather not say here in public, but I am worried about his health, Mr. Hainsworth, and worried about his sanity. It's because of something that happened that day out at Cacus Island.
G.K. Chesterton believed that a long Sunday walk and a glass of beer could put us spiritually in the company of an Alexander the Great. Others disagree. A true adventurer takes genuine risks, plays for keeps, and does not count the cost. I shall return in a moment with Act Two.
Let's pretend. Let's pretend he's invisible.
Well, we don't play Let's Pretend anymore. Or do we? Don't some people still pretend that all children are alike, that all children can go to the same classes and learn the same way? Well, that isn't true. No two children are alike, and we just can't pretend 8 million handicapped children are invisible and simply not educate them. Because we know handicapped children can learn, and the law says they have a right to the special education they need to learn as much as they can. Still, there are people who pretend there are no handicapped children, or there is no law. If you have a child with a handicap, don't let anyone pretend he's invisible. we have free information that can help him get the special education he needs. Write Closer Look, Box 1492, Washington, D.C., 20013.
That's 20013. All right.
I still play pretend.
I do, too.
Yeah.
I pretend people like me.
Hey, a little bit about the writer of the show, Percy Grainger. He was had a brief acting career in the 1970s. He later wrote for As the World Turns, and he wrote 31 episodes, I believe. Hang on, let me get back here. Where to go? There we are. 32 episodes of the Mystery Theater. We've shared some already before. Hope Springs Eternal, we've shared. The reunion is scheduled. The ninth volume, we've shared. The Laughing Maiden is tonight. The Ice Palace, we've shared.
I see a pattern.
Now Time Out of Mind, we've shared. So he's done some interesting shows that we have shared. It looks like there's a couple more here that looks like I should be putting on the list as well. So interesting little guy, Mr. Percy Grainger, who wrote tonight's story.
And it is a good one. This is true adventure. I mean, you got a lot of elements of adventure in here. Thrilling story for like a young mind or maybe young at heart minds like ourselves. But
yes.
And I'm ready to get some more of that. So let's move on to part two of The Laughing Maiden from CBS Radio.
Which is larger, the universe or the mind of man? The philosopher would say the mind, because it is capable of comprehending the entire universe plus 1 inch. But man is also the only animal who will inflict pain on himself needlessly, who will torture himself with the remorseless workings of his own mind. It's a vicious circle, and given the power of the mind, sometimes a fatal one.
I followed Tom down to the wharf where the Laughing Maiden was moored. I was shocked by her appearance. She'd taken on the aspect of a ghost ship. But if the change in the boat surprised me, it was nothing compared to the change in my old friend.
He's down below Mr. Hainsworth in the cabin.
You say that he stayed in there for 3 months?
With the portholes closed and the blinds drawn shut. Who's there?
Ernie, it's me, Jason.
Jason?
Oh, man, it is stifling in here. How can you breathe? Tom, open the window.
No. Don't. They might see in.
Ernie, what's the matter? Who might see in?
The syndicate people, Mr. Hainsworth. He's terrified of them.
But why? Have they been after him?
Well, it's because of what I've got here.
What?
Tom, were you followed? I don't think so, Mr. Chowders.
You think the syndicate is watching him?
You can't be too careful.
Ernie, you made a prisoner of yourself on your own boat for 3 months.
I can't ever escape.
What are you talking about? You don't know where the treasure is.
No, but you're wrong, Jason. You're wrong. Wait till you see. You remember that day on Caicos? Remember when we spotted the yacht's masthead? I started taking pictures. Well, look.
These are the pictures that you took?
Yeah. This one of the sunset. Look down there in the corner.
That's one of the rocks on the beach.
You see how the sunlight is striking it?
Hey, there's markings on it.
We walked right past that rock and never saw a thing because the light wasn't hitting it at the right angle. But here, in the photograph with the sun just about to set, the markings show up perfectly. It's the rock Captain Kidd carved. His map on. Now,
All we have to do is go back, decipher the stone, and go straight to the treasure.
Yeah, and what about the syndicate?
Well, that's the problem, Mr. Haynesworth. There don't seem to be any way we can go back there, and Mr. Chowders has been tearing himself apart from the inside out over
it. We're so close to it. We're so close. There it is, Jason, in the photograph. We found the rock.
But you can't go out there, Ernie. The Laughing Maiden couldn't outrun a high-powered boat.
I know.
It's been like this all these months. He gnaws at him, won't give him any rest. He knows it's certain death to try to recover that treasure, and yet he sits there for hours just staring at that photograph, trying to decipher the markings with a magnifying glass.
Jason, now that you're here, we can do it.
Now you listen to me. You listen to me. There's no way I'm going back to Caicos, and neither are you. It is not humanly possible to get that treasure and survive. Do you understand that? Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yes, but...
All right.
Mr. Haynesworth, where are you going?
I am catching the evening bus to Puerto Plata. And from there, I'm flying to Miami. I got a job lined up there working for a big company that has a fleet of charter boats.
You mean you're going to be a skipper on one of a string of boats?
No. Actually, I'll be working on shore in the marina. Well, okay, maybe it's no great shakes and not what I hoped for, but... But look, it's a steady job. The first steady job I've had in a long time.
But you can't leave Mr. Chowders like
Ernie will be okay once he faces up to reality, Tom. Because, you see, that's what I am doing. That's what we all have to do sooner or later. I'm sorry, Tom. Good luck.
Jason? Jason, is that you?
Huh?
Say, Jason, when did you get here? I guess I didn't see you right off. The light's kind of dim, but... It's safer that way.
Oh, boy. He's in a bad way, isn't he, Tom? You're right. I just can't leave him like this. But the first thing is to get him topside for some fresh air and then ventilate this cabin. It smells like a tomb in here.
Yes, sir, Mr. Haynesworth.
Now, look, you rustle us up something to eat. And then this evening when it's dark, well, we'll talk.
That stew was terrific. Meal like the old days. I feel like a new man. It's Jason's being back that's done it. Swear to the good Lord.
Coffee's ready, Mr. Haynesworth.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
You still carry your gun, Jason?
I never go anywhere unarmed on principle.
Coffee, Mr. Chowders?
Yeah, sure, Ernie.
Ernie, every instinct in my body is against this venture. Look, isn't there any way that I can talk you out of it?
No, the way I got it figured, the syndicate yacht won't make any kind of move until they see we've actually got the treasure dug up.
I guess that answers my question, doesn't it? But look, I'm telling you right now, I am not going to be part of any plan that calls for us to try outrunning these guys and the Laughing Maiden. That is suicide.
Well, what's an alternative?
What about using a seaplane or a helicopter? I can fly it if we can put enough money in together to rent one. I think that Ernie's right that they wouldn't move in on us until we had recovered the treasure. So that means it's primarily a matter of timing. Now, Ernie, if you and Tom take the boat out and locate the treasure, I'll come in for a landing at the last moment. We load and take off.
They'll shoot us down. The word is that yacht is equipped to deal with any contingency, including aircraft.
Well, what do you suggest, then?
Well, what if you go out in advance in a second boat and hide in one of the coves on the windward side of the island? And Tom and I will follow, find the treasure, loot it, and sail around the far side as if trying to make a run for it. And we pull a quick shift of cargo and you slip back out of sight. And when the yacht overtakes us, we surrender the chests, filled with sand, like a joke played on history by Captain Kidd.
And then we rendezvous later, right?
I don't know. It's possible, I suppose.
Well, if only we knew who the head of that syndicate was.
You mean nobody knows?
No. The rumor is it's a patrone named Guillermo Galiban. He owns a 52-foot yacht, high-powered, with a mast identical to the one we've seen on the horizon out at Caicos.
Have you and anyone else ever seen the yacht itself?
Well, he keeps it in a secluded cove among the cliffs.
I saw it once from a distance.
It's been nearly 4 months since our last visit to Caicos. So maybe this guy Galaban no longer has his goons watching you.
Well, in any case, it's a chance we'll have to take.
We'll slip out of the harbor as soon as it's fully dark and gain Caicos in the early morning hours. By daybreak, we should be digging. If we're not followed, good. If we are, and we find the treasure, well, then we'll take it from there. We left the harbor as soon as it was dark. Even if the syndicate didn't discover our departure until the following morning, and even if all went smoothly on Caicos, we'd still have no more than a couple hours head start on them. And of course, it would be foolhardy to return to Monte Cristi. So we took extra fuel, enough to get us to Rum Key in the Bahamas. There we could refuel and press on to Florida, and we hoped safety. But the first step was finding the treasure. It was still dark when we reached Caicos.
Okay, Tom. We're near the shoals. Kill the engine.
You hear anything that sounds like we're being followed?
No. Are you sure we're in the right spot?
Oh, I got these rocks memorized. This is where I took the picture, all right. Yeah. So,
that's the rock. Jason, Tom, we found it.
42, 43.
You're veering off. Keep to your left.
28, 49, 50. How was I by the compass?
Due east.
Right on schedule. The sun's just coming up.
Yeah, well, this should be the spot.
Tom, give us the shovels.
Right.
And you take up a position on that rise of ground over there and keep an eye out for that yacht.
Jason, you and I have some digging to do.
Look, we got a hole 6 feet deep and 10 feet in diameter, and so far there's no sign of anything.
Don't give up now. Let's just keep going.
Ernie, did it occur to you that we have no way of knowing what the numbers stood for on that rock? That could have been feet or yards or leagues, for that matter.
Tom, how's the horizon?
All clear so far.
Yeah. Almost noon.
We made it. Got away undetected.
Come on, it's gotta be here.
Oh, you think I'm gonna spend the rest of my life on this island?
Maybe. I got news for you. We aren't leaving till we find that treasure.
Yeah, you mean you're not ever going to admit to yourself that it is not here?
Never. What was that? Jason, my shovel, it hit something.
We found it. We found the lost treasure of the Quedog Merchant.
Mr. Chowders, Mr. Hinz.
What?
I just saw it. The mast, the yacht. It just pulled into view on the horizon.
What? No, they can't have. It's not fair.
Ernie, calm down. Calm down, will you? Tom, are you sure that you saw it?
I'm positive.
Okay. Now, look, you go back and you keep watch. If they start to move toward us, you let us know at once.
Yes, sir.
They're bound to be scanning the island, so stay low. Don't let them see our position. Meanwhile, we'll just get these chests open.
Yeah.
See if we've got anything that's worth fighting for.
I'll break the lock with my shovel.
Yeah, the lock's off. Now, at last.
Look.
Oh,
bags of gold dust. Silver bars. We're rich, Jason. We're rich.
It is one thing to find a treasure and another to keep it. How simple now seem the months of research and work. How minor the agonies and insignificant the risks compared to the challenge our friends face now. Confronted with such a seemingly insurmountable situation, most people would quietly fold their tents and steal away. But Ernie Chowders is not the kind of person to give up. I'll return shortly with our final act.
I like pickles, but they don't like me.
And your stomach sometimes, you know.
I like pizza, but it doesn't like me.
And your stomach sometimes, you know.
Digel's special combination of antacid and anti-gas ingredients gives you fast, gentle relief from acid indigestion, heartburn, and gas in just minutes.
I like hot dogs, but they don't like me.
And your stomach sometimes, you know.
For occasional use, only as directed.
Only as directed. Just guzzle the whole thing down. Doesn't matter.
We had that Digel around the house about that time as well. It's a pill that you chewed and tasted like billiard chalk.
Yes.
Not that I went around tasting billiard chalk, but okay, so I did, but it's okay.
It's not a lot.
Yep. So close, but yet so far to that buried treasure.
That we are. This tale is building up.
Yep. Yeah, that's that nasty old syndicate. That nasty old syndicate.
Why don't they just say mafia and get it over with?
Yeah, you know what? It's true. That's true. Is that not what the syndicate usually was referred to as, the mafia?
Yeah, a syndicate was an organized crime. You know, a syndication is an organization. So, yeah, organized crime. Who else?
So if we were to syndicate Erie House, we would be organized criminals?
Well, we'd be an organization. We wouldn't act like it's a crime that we're on.
Well, we have been a little criminal with some punchlines from time to time.
Subject everyone to bits of us in between these segments of radio programs. We apologize profusely for that.
Gar says I prefer disorganized crime. That was a fun movie. It was with Ed O'Neill and Fred Gwynne, I think, were two of the several actors in there. Hilarious movie. One that almost nobody found, but I found it on DVD somewhere. My wife loves it, too, so gets pulled out every once in a while to watch.
Interesting pairing, those two.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, he may have felt he got pigeonholed, but he got a little bit more work than I think he realized he had, and especially, you know, he got a chance to go on to Broadway and do a lot of different things, and he got a chance to do many different things right here on the Radio Mystery Theater as well. Good old Herman Munster.
Yep. And Ed O'Neill, Al Bundy.
And Ed O'Neill, yeah. I have enjoyed everything Ed O'Neill did, even when he did that hour-long Dragnet series. I think it lasted most of one season, maybe all of one season. It didn't come back for a second season. But even though I haven't liked all the other versions of Dragnet outside of Jack Webb's, I kind of like this one. I just wish I'd called it anything but Dragnet, because it was just using the names of what was already out there and established. You know, it would have been just as good with any other name, maybe better.
Nope, they're just riding the coattails.
Yep, and that's what they think they're going to do. And how often does that actually work? I have to tell you, not very often.
Now, you got to do your own thing to make things work. Got to do your own thing.
No, yeah, no. Ed O'Neill with Ernest Borgnine, unless he was the sound man on that one. Ernest Borgnine was not on that movie. No.
Oh.
Sorry, Gar.
He auditioned, but he didn't. He didn't get in.
Yeah, yeah. And that's weird, because Ernest Borgnine didn't have to audition for a lot. He just threatened people, you know. No, he didn't.
Yeah.
He was a nice guy. Very nice guy.
He was.
That would be a threat.
He was fun as Cabby in Escape from New York.
He was. He was. And I've told everybody, I had a friend that was in Escape from New York, Jay Bach, who's one of our sometime cast members. He was a professional stuntman at the time, and he was in the first draft that got blown up as they were trying to escape New York. So that was always a cool thing.
And Ernest Borgnine was good in that movie, Marty.
Excellent in that movie, Marty, yeah.
Yes, yes. Good old Marty.
Actually, I've seen him, and he was wonderful in Bad Day at Black Rock. with Spencer Tracy. Spencer Tracy was a star in that one, and Ernest was inside waiting to do a scene, and Spencer Tracy was just wandering around out the front of the building, and Ernest kept thinking, what the hell is that guy doing out there? He said, oh, he's stealing the show. That's what he's doing out there.
Indeed. Yep. All right, so we are going to wrap up our CBS Radio Mystery Theater presentation. We got some more treats for you right after that. So here comes part three of The Laughing Maiden from CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
Three of the world's richest men are at this moment in a very singular situation. They are on a desert island in the middle of an ocean, in the immediate proximity of their entire fortune, and being held at bay by an ominous yacht reputedly owned by a powerful and very mysterious syndicate. The situation can perhaps most perfectly be described as a dilemma. As we rejoin them, we find them doing what human beings often do in dilemmas. Nothing.
What are we going to do?
I don't know.
But we got to do something. We can't just sit here all day staring at millions of dollars in jewels.
Tom, let me have the binoculars, huh?
It's unfair. It's just unfair. How did they know we were here?
Once they saw the Laughing Maiden missing from the harbor this morning.
If they'd shown up an hour ago, I wouldn't have minded so much. But I got here just as we found the treasure.
It looks like they're just going to sit out there all day till we make the first move.
There's only one solution.
What's that?
I don't see anything for it but rebury the treasure.
Oh. Now, look, let's be sane about this, Ernie. What else can we do?
The shoals.
Huh?
The Barracoa Bank. Where's that map? That's it. That's the way out of here. See? Right there.
Yeah, the Barracoa Bank.
Among other things I did in preparing to find this treasure was to study the surrounding waters here until I could navigate them in my sleep. Now, the Barracoa Bank is a reef system which extends from North Caicos to Providenciales Island. That's 10 miles. 10 miles of shallow water.
So?
Very shallow water. At least in places. Enough to serve our purpose. It's not too shallow for the draft of the Laughing Maiden, but it's dangerous for a boat the size of that one out there on the horizon. If they tried to follow us through that water, they'd crack up and sink. And in between those reefs is some of the deepest water in the Atlantic.
Ernie, it's no good trying to outrun them.
You ought to look at the head start we'd have.
Even with a head start.
10 miles! By the time they got around those reefs, we'd be halfway across the Caicos Passage.
Yes, and on our way to what? Open water. In order to take advantage of the Barracoa Bank, we'd have to go in the wrong direction. The next island of any size is over 100 miles away.
Then what can we do?
Tom's right. Until we can think of some way to get around that yacht, we've got no choice but to rebury the treasure.
Syndicate know our every move. Gollybad must have half the villagers in Monte Cristi working for him. Oh, I'd like to get hold of Gollybad and break his neck.
Let's try coming up with more practical options, Ernie. Anyway, we cut it, we're back to square one.
How come you're so keen on this all of a sudden?
What do you mean?
Yesterday you couldn't wait to get to Miami on that job.
There's a couple of $1 million in treasure out there, old buddy. I win. Miami, that may be the answer.
Miami?
Let's assume for the moment that Ernie's right, that the syndicate's information comes from spies, and that they've got the Laughing Maiden under constant surveillance. That means that there is no way we can ever approach Caicos from here or any other port along the Dominican coast. Yeah, our only chance would be to approach from the other direction.
The open sea?
Through the Bahamas from Miami.
How do we do that without arousing suspicion?
Wait a minute. I'll go on to Miami as I planned by myself. In a couple of days' time, you let the word out around the village that you've got a lucrative job lined up in Sanchez or Samana Bay, someplace down the coast away from Caicos. You sail down to pick up this, you know, wealthy fisherman, and from there you take a plane and join me in Miami. Right. And then we rent a boat large enough to get us the 700 miles to Caicos.
Well, that means leaving the Laughing Maiden behind. No, I don't like it.
The Laughing Maiden's no good to us in this situation. It's too old and too slow. I'm going to go back to my hotel now. I'll catch the bus out of here tomorrow. Here you are. Here's the address where I'll be staying in Miami. Oh, yeah, just one other thing. This Mr. Galiban, where did you say his place was?
Just this side of Isabelica, on the road to Puerto Plata. Why?
I'll expect to see you by Sunday.
Yeah.
Good.
What do you think, Tom?
I don't like the idea of abandoning the Laughing Maiden.
No. I meant about Jason.
Mr. Hainsworth?
Yeah. Something's bothering me about him. The way he suddenly came up with that plan.
I think you're imagining things.
No. No, I don't think so. He was planning to go to Miami all along, and now he's got us going there, too.
And why did he come back to Monte Cristo?
Well, Mr. Hainsworth wouldn't betray us.
That's crazy.
Well, he left us 4 years ago, didn't he? Oh, he's always looked out for number one. That's who he's looking out for now. Tom, I want you to follow him.
Follow Mr. Hainsworth?
Yeah, that's right. Until he gets on that bus tomorrow morning, I want you to see every place he goes and report back to me.
When I left the Laughing Maiden that night, for the last time, as it turned out, I had a strange feeling. The information I was hearing about this syndicate was leaving something out, and a new suspicion was beginning to dawn on me. There was one thing I had to check out if I could. I didn't know it at the time, but where I went that evening saved my life. We met in Miami as planned. Both Ernie and Tom were acting strangely, though. They seemed reserved and distant. I didn't pay much attention to this at the time. I just chalked it up to nerves. Everything went well, however. That is, until we arrived at Caicos. We planned to accomplish the entire operation at night.
Clouds aren't moving at all.
I don't understand it. The Weather Bureau in Miami said clear weather for 5 days. Absolutely no possibility of cloud cover.
Just our luck.
It's being off the Laughing Maiden that's responsible.
Oh, be quiet. Jason, I thought you had this all planned out. A full moon, clear skies, plenty of light to get the treasure and get away safely before daybreak. Now the whole night's lost. Are you sure the Bureau told you clear weather?
Yeah. Hey, Tom. Is there any breeze up there at all?
No, not a whisper, Mr. Hainsworth. Captain Kidd himself might as well be protecting that treasure.
We had to wait for dawn to begin our work. 3 hours later, with Tom on lookout, Ernie and I had dug down to the treasure. It was still there.
Tom, any sign of that yacht?
He's waving all clear.
I don't believe it.
Let's get the chest down to the beach and into the lifeboat and get out of here.
That's it. Now we're all set to row out to the boat.
Well, Ernie, it looks like this time we made it, huh? Let's get Tom and take off.
Hey, Chris, Mr. Chowder.
What is it?
It's there. I saw it. The syndicate's yacht.
No. I will not accept this as possible. I will not.
Ernie, will you calm down?
Jason, give me your gun. I'm going after him.
You're crazy.
Give me the gun or she'll help me. I'll swim out there.
Hold my revolver. I've got to stop Ernie.
Ernie, Ernie, are you okay?
Okay, Tom, it works. I'll take the gun now.
Hey, wait a minute.
Just stay back, you double-crossing bum. I ought to blow your head off right here.
No, Mr. Chowder.
Don't worry, Tom. Get the rope out of the life.
What is this? What are you doing?
You thought you had us all fooled, didn't you?
What are you talking about?
The syndicate knew I was on to something, didn't they? But they could never have guessed it was an actual photograph of the Rock.
Must have been flabbergasted when you told them.
Me?
Here's the rope, Mr. Charlie.
Okay, Jason, lie down. Lie down.
Tom,
hog time.
Ernie, will you explain what you're talking about?
I had Tom Polly the night you left the Laughing Maiden. He wouldn't believe me either. I knew something was fishy. Sure enough, he tailed you right to Galiban's fortress.
Just listen to me. I only went there to sneak a look at his yacht.
And what for?
Everything I was hearing about the syndicate sounded like a lot of mythology made up to explain things that didn't have any other explanation. There wasn't any smoking gun on this guy Galiban. No hard evidence. I wanted to check his boat just to make sure. Ernie, it isn't armed. It's a normal pleasure boat.
No, you forget. I saw it too, Mr. Hainsworth. Only I saw it in broad daylight. And it's armed, all right. It's armed.
Ah, what you saw must have been the rigs and chairs they have on the decks for deep sea fishing.
No. I saw a gun.
Yeah, harpoon guns. How far away was the boat when you saw it, Tom, huh? 300 yards, 500? How old are you, Tom? How good is your eyesight?
You aren't getting around us that easily, pal. If it's not Galiban's yacht, then whose is it?
I don't even think there is a syndicate. There's no shred of concrete evidence to prove it exists.
It's all time, Mr. Charles.
Tom, you listen to me. You listen to me. What Ernie's saying doesn't even make sense. If I was working for this syndicate, why am I here now? Once I knew where the treasure was, wouldn't I have just told them?
Oh, he's got a point.
Don't listen to him. Come on.
You can't leave me tied up here.
Your friends out there can pick you up.
I tell you, I don't know who they are. I'll die here.
Get in the boat, Tom.
Now, wait a minute. I thought we agreed if the yacht showed, we wouldn't try to take the treasure with us.
Are you crazy? I'm not leaving it behind again.
But we can't outrun that yacht.
We're going to do what we should have done all along. Head across the Barracoa Bank and lose them.
That boat's not the Laughing Maiden, Mr. Chowders. Its draft is too deep. We'd crack up for
sure. Oh, no, he won't. Come on.
No, I can't. I'm sorry, but it's foolish.
Tom, don't force me to shoot you.
Well, you wouldn't. You
get in this lifeboat and start rowing.
I'm sorry, Mr. Hainsworth. It doesn't look like any of us has much of a chance.
Tom was right. They never had a chance. The boat hit the first reef, and in less than a minute, no trace of them remained. Tom, Ernie, and the treasure were on their way into one of the deepest trenches in the Atlantic Ocean. I managed to get myself free. I was curious why the yacht had not yet come into view. I picked up the binoculars and climbed the dune. It was then I saw the sight that has kept me silent for 5 years. On the mast, a flag was unfurled. It was a black flag with skull and crossbones. And then before my very eyes, the flag and the mast vanished. The ghost of Captain Kidd had guarded his treasure well.
Ernie Chowders was an experienced seaman and knew he didn't have a chance going across the Barracoa Bank. Yet, that's precisely what he did. But what of Jason? How did he escape from Caicos? I'll tell you that in a moment.
Hello, I'm Rick Barry of the Golden State Warriors. As a professional basketball player, I know that good defense makes a winner. Cancer chemotherapy is one of the most important kinds of defense I can think of. It helps arrest and control cancer, a ravaging disease that afflicts one-third of our adult population. Chemotherapy treatment, which means the medicinal use of chemical agents, can control some of the most common forms of cancer. Proper and timely use of this treatment can result in patients leading extended and productive lives. But scientists have only begun to tap the pool of therapeutic drugs at their disposal. To continue this costly process, your support is needed. Send a check today to Chemotherapy, Box 8, New York 10028. Remember, the best offense against cancer is a good defense, like chemotherapy.
Rick Barry is right. Chemotherapy can relieve suffering from cancer while it checks the growth of the runaway cancer cells. Your donation will continue this relief. Think about it. Then send a check to Chemotherapy, Box 8, New York 10028.
Jason Haynesworth didn't have long to wait for rescuers. Within a day, another party of would-be treasure hunters came to the island, following the eternal lure of buried treasure. A final note, considering the fact that the syndicate yacht was an illusion, Tom was right all along. If they had stayed with the Laughing Maiden, they'd all be alive and rich today. Our cast included Norman Rose, William Griffith, and Arnold Moss. The entire production was under the direction of Hyman Brown. Radio Mystery Theater was sponsored in part by Buick Motor Division and True Value Hardware Stores. This is E.G. Marshall inviting you to return to our Mystery Theater for another adventure in the macabre. Until next time, pleasant dreams.
Talk 57. There's a nice little station ID there as we wrap up our story from CBS Radio Mystery Theater. Kind of a cool ending there.
Yeah, not something that we all didn't necessarily expect there.
No, I did not. That caught me blindsided. Captain.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and one more quick thing on Percy Grainger. He actually acted in two episodes of the Mystery Theater, The Reunion, which he wrote, and The Dominant Personality. I'm not sure whether he wrote that one or not. I can just take that, check that real
quick. Dave, I hear sirens. What did you do now?
Let's see. I went and had an extra ice cream bar when I shouldn't have, and the wife called the police on me, so I'm sorry. You know, when I give them an ice cream bar, they'll go away.
Yeah. They'll throw the book at you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Percy Grainger also wrote that one as well. And I have to check that one out. But the reunion is actually scheduled. I have to get that one pulled up because I kind of waited for that when it was time for, you know, like family reunions and school reunions and things like that, which is right about now. And I also have... a WCRS radio stage that I wrote that kind of takes place during a class reunion or school reunion.
That was a lot of interesting facts. And if you're hungry for even more facts.
Or not.
Gary House Radio proudly presents a garrulous moral of the story.
Definite apologies to Brother Gar. Some things are more precious than buried treasure, like meeting a pirate and saving your own life. That would be it.
Weissmuller approves.
Oh, well, you know, if Johnny approves, the guy got stuck in a jungle all those years. Hey, who am I to fight that one too much?
There you go.
I can guarantee that the next moral is better than this one was.
And that'll be a moral probably maybe having something to do with our next feature. Yankee Yarns. Now, we've had
good
one
Yankee
or two of these in the past, haven't we?
We have had one that I believe we've had in the past. It was kind of an interesting tale-telling program from New England, Boston area.
Boston.
It ran from 1943 to 51, and it was an entertaining show about New England created by Alton H. Blackington, touting himself as a storyteller. Alton weaves tales that are all alternately amazing, eccentric, horrifying, and comical. His yarns include stories about sticky Boston streets of 1919 when a gigantic tank of molasses burst and coated the town, or of a silly Connecticutans who gather a pool of $10 million to mine gold at the bottom of the ocean. Yankee yarns found themselves to be told in many forms throughout the years, from radio to newspaper stories to lectures, and finally, in a book, radio listeners pestered Alton long and hard for scripts of his broadcast, so much that he finally wrote himself a book in 1954. So, whether you're in the mood for a spine tingler or a throat giggle, Yankee Yarns will weave. Will weave. It says you satisfied.
Yes. Can we make a Yankee Afghan out of Yankee Yarns?
I don't think so. Yeah. Maybe a nice sweater, but yeah. Not an Afghan.
Yes.
It's a short show, so, you know.
All right. Let's get started. It's called Buried Treasure, and it's from
January 23rd, 1945.
WBZ presents an audition of Alden Hall Blackington in Yankee Yarns. Before we listen to Blackie's story tonight, let's pause for a brief moment and think of the voice which makes him clearly audible to those listening at home, the voice of WBZ's powerful transmitter. A dozen airline miles out in the harbor, it blankets metropolitan Boston with a signal of perfect clarity, leaping at the same instant to the far corners of all the New England states with velvet smoothness. For the moment, consider its daily impact on the 3 million people who live within 30 miles of the State House in Beacon Hill. In this area is 69% of the population of Massachusetts, over one-third of all the people in New England. All but an insignificant 3% of the homes here have radios, making it more radio-minded than any other section of the whole country. The heart of this rich market is Suffolk County, and its leading city is Boston, home of WBZ. And now, here's Blackie.
This is a story of pirate treasure. But unlike the stories of sea chests hidden deep in the sands of Cape Cod or Nova Scotia beyond the reach of treasure hunters, this cache of gold was found. The man who located it, through a genuine pirate's parchment map, is Mr. George F. Benner, former custodian of the Marine Museum in the Old State House at Boston. When Mr. Benner was a young lad, he used to spend his summer vacations in the little village of Middlesex, Vermont, some 6 or 7 miles above Montpelier. His uncle had a good-sized farm on the North Branch Road, and on rainy afternoons, his Aunt Emmeline used to let him rummage around the attic, to his great delight. In the soft, warm darkness under the eaves, there was mystery and romance. Stacks of old magazines and books, old-fashioned flintlock guns and powder horns, a spinning wheel and sword, and the sweet-smelling yabs that hung from the rafters. And there was the trunk, the pirate's trunk, that Aunt Emmeline said could never be opened because it didn't belong to her. Someday, perhaps, when you're older, George, I won't promise, but perhaps if you're a good boy, well, maybe I'm getting ahead of my story. Let's go back a bit. Emmeline Benna Lewis came from Maine. She was born in Waldeboro, not far from where my own grandmother was born, and she was a descendant of the seafaring Benners of Revolutionary fame. She died just a few years ago in Middlesex, Vermont, at the age of 102. One October night many years ago, when dusk was falling on the little town of Middlesex and a raw, gusty wind was plucking at the shutters of the old Lewis farm, Mrs. Lewis lighted a big, fat kerosene lamp and placed it on the living room table by the window. As she drew the shades, big raindrops splashed on the pane, and she noticed, coming up the road, the strange figure of a man. She'd never seen anyone quite like him. He was leaning forward against the wind, and upon his stooped shoulders, he held a good-sized trunk. He crossed the road and came toward the house. Mrs. Lewis was all alone. It would be hours before her husband would return from Montpelier. The next neighbors were some distance up the road, but she boldly opened the door and said, Oh, my, do come in. It's so cold and windy. And then she had a good look at the stranger. If this had been Nantucket or Ellsworth or Point Judith, he would have seen part of the seascape. But up there in the Vermont hills, he was like an apparition. He was old, probably 80 or so, and thin, but he had broad shoulders. And the hand that held onto the brass-bound trunk was big and gnarled. But it wasn't these things that Mrs. Lewis noticed, nor his white hair and mustache and deep, piercing eyes under shaggy brows. It was the earrings, big as half dollars, that flashed in the flickering lamplight of her cozy kitchen. And that wasn't all. Around the man's waist was a faded and curiously folded sash. He was a sailor, all right. But what was he doing up there in Vermont? And what did he have in the leather-covered trunk that he'd put down beside the doorsteps? You must be cold and hungry, she said warmly. Thank you, ma'am. I am both. And the old man's face lighted up as Mrs. Lewis motioned him to a comfortable chair by the fireplace. Now I'll poke up the fire and get you a bite to eat. When he had finished the meal and lighted his pipe, he sighed deeply. I've come a long way up here to find an old shipmate of mine. We sailed together for years. Singapore, Formosa, Madagascar, around the Horn, East and West Indies, slave trade, mutiny and all. 50 years, ma'am. Last I heard of him, he was living down here in the village. But nobody seems to know where he is. And his house is empty. I'm afraid he's dead. He tapped his pipe on the hearth and sighed again. With such a nor'east storm making up, I pushed on. If I could stay the night, ma'am, I'd be mighty grateful. Well, before the old fellow went to bed in the spare room, he fetched his trunk into the shed and with a polite bow said good night. Mrs. Lewis stayed up until her husband came home, and they agreed the old sailor should stay just as long as he wanted to. But next morning he was up bright and early, asking when the stage was due. And when he'd had a good breakfast, he pulled out a fat purse and laid down a dollar bill. Mrs. Lewis smiled. Why, we wouldn't think of charging you. Well, he said, I'd kind of like to ask another favor, glancing toward the trunk. It's pretty heavy, ma'am, and I'm not as husky as I was once. Could I leave it for a week or so and pick it up when I come back? I'll gladly pay you. And just then the stage came clattering into the square, and the old man, earrings glittering in the sun, climbed aboard and was gone. The days stretched into weeks, weeks into months. 5 years went by, and not a sight or sound of the sailor. His brass-bound, leather-covered trunk was lugged into the attic under the eaves where the catnip hung. And there on warm afternoons, when the summer stillness was broken only by the far-off rumblings of thunder and the nearer chirpings of the robins crying for rain, young George Benner of Boston would sit and ponder over what was in that trunk and how he could get his Aunt Emmeline's permission to open it. Aunt Emmeline had a sister named Patience, who smoked an old clay pipe and told fortunes with a teacup. And one day, when her nephew was visiting the Vermont farm, she whirled his teacup around and said excitedly, Georgie, I see a fortune coming to you through a paper. It looks like a map or something. And I see pirate gold. Lots of it. Well, that boy was so excited he couldn't sleep that night, thinking about the pirate's trunk up in the attic, filled in all probability with doubloons and sovereigns and diamonds and jade from far-off places. And the next day he pleaded with his Aunt Emmeline to open the trunk that had, for over 20 years now, reposed among the cobwebs under the eaves. Finally, just to keep him quiet, she said, when you're 18, George, if the trunk is still here and no word has come from the old man, who would have been well over 100, I'll let you open it, but I'm afraid you'll be disappointed. In the years that followed, Benner was a busy young man. And when World War I broke out, he was even busier helping Uncle Sam. And it wasn't until after that war that he went back to the old farm in Vermont. His uncle had died, and so had Aunt Patience. But Aunt Emmeline was there, and so was the trunk. But somehow, with the passing of time and the war and all, it had lost its magic. Or was it just because the boy was now a man? It so happened that there was another George visiting in Middlesex, Vermont, a fellow from Maine. And the two Georges often went fishing together. One day, George Benner told his friend about the old sailor's trunk, and they decided to open it. So the next day, Aunt Emmeline led the way up the stairs to the attic, and they dragged out the old trunk. I wouldn't let you touch it, she said, but that old man said he didn't have a relative in the world, and I know he must be dead by now. So go ahead and cut the straps. A single hammer blow split the lock, and with a creak of rusty hinges and a puff of musty dust, up came the cover, revealing a mass of old, moth-eaten clothes, and under the faded coat, there was a carved whale's tooth, an old broken quadrant, some seashells, and a badly stained copy of Scott's Pirate. George Bender picked up the mildewed volume and opened it callously. Opened it to a folded piece of vellum such as pirates used to make maps on. His heart beat fast, and when he unfolded it, he was too excited to talk. For there was a map of the main coast near the Kennebec River with a star marking a small bay. And under it was written with very poor writing and horrible spelling the following paragraph. Stand abreast Quartz Boulder. Bring top in line with hill. North 1/2 mile it lies, 12 fathoms. Northeast, near big trees, under stone. Well, a few days later, two very excited young men took the boat to Bath, Maine, where they hired a motorboat and loaded it with provisions. They took a compass, spades and picks, and several bags to put the treasure in. But there were hundreds of bays and inlets looking more or less alike on that part of the Maine coast. So all day they sailed back and forth, scanning the shore for the quartz boulder and the clump of tall trees. The October sun was dropping behind the flaming oaks and maples, and long shadows were stealing across the calm water when suddenly George Benner shouted, "Look over there! Look at that big rock!" And sure enough, about 40 feet above the waterline, a big boulder caught the sunlight and sparkled brilliantly. "And see that tree, George? It's just where the clump of trees is on the map." The sun had gone down now, and it was getting cold. So they went ashore and made camp, not daring to leave the spot they'd found. But long before sunrise, they were up, and after a quick turn around the cove, they located the spot indicated on the map. 2 hours later, they found the flat stone, and with crowbars and round sticks, they rolled it a few inches to one side and dug feverishly into the sandy soil. 2 feet down, their shovel struck another rock. They scooped away the earth, pried the stone loose, and dug deeper. Few treasure hunters have been so rewarded, for among the pebbles and dirt, there were fragments of rotted wood, a piece of rusted metal, and part of a barrel head. Mr. Benner shoved his hands into the crumbling earth, and his fist closed on a hard, round object, black with age. He scraped it against the edge of his shovel and saw the glint of gold under the grime. "Why," he said, "there must be thousands of them here. Get the bags, quick." And without stopping to examine what they'd found, they dumped handful after handful into the canvas bags. They were reaching deep into the hole to get the last of the coins embedded in the rotted wood when they heard voices on the hill above them. Two men were coming along the shore toward the cove. So they hustled the bags aboard the motorboat and shoved off. But they were afraid to land in Bath, and they sailed on to Gloucester and spent the night there, sleeping on top of their treasure. Late the next afternoon, their little motorboat nosed into Boston Harbor and tied up at the wharf on Northern Avenue. Mr. Benner went ashore and telephoned a Boston bank, and in no time a car came down to the wharf and the bags were safe inside. Once behind locked doors, with the coins spread out on newspapers, the treasure hunters all but collapsed. They hadn't realized what a strain they'd been under. In describing this treasure to Carl Wotton of the Boston Sunday Herald, Mr. Benner said they received about $20,000 for the lot, dividing it equally. He will never, as long as he lives, forget the thrill of running his fingers through those black, heavy doubloons and pillar dollars of the 17th century. And among them was a package containing a beautiful pearl necklace and a 9-inch golden cross, all studded with gems. They always intended to go back to that spot on the Maine coast to search further, but they never did. If you have in your attic an old trunk or chest or box left behind by some pirate, call me up. There's nothing I'd rather do than go digging for buried treasure.
Thank you, Blackie. In designing this program for you, we've had in mind the type of evening entertainment which will attract the favorable notice of the largest portion of WBZ's audience. Another important consideration must inevitably be the potentiality of this audience in buying power. Taking the metropolitan Boston portion of our listeners only, it is of note that its purchasers have recorded the highest per capita number of retail transactions in the United States. Ranking as the 9th largest city in America, it holds 5th place as a manufacturing center and in retail volume. Strategically situated on the global air map of commercial travel, its airport is now being stepped up to the size needed to compete with that of any other city. WBZ, therefore, serves an audience of prime interest to anyone desirous of merchandising in this, our great nation. And we believe, too, that WBZ listeners are the most likely to be interested in the type of program which brings them Stories of New England by Alton Hall Blackington.
are having a good 4th of July weekend.
Yes.
And as the man said last night, cool with the boom booms over day.
Yeah. Yep. And of course, the good old Yankee Doodle makes us think of a good old Revolutionary War in times like that.
Yep. And do you have a little something for this one?
I do have a little something for this one. A little something more than I had for the last one.
Eerie House Radio flinchingly presents... What? A garrulous moral of a story. Doggone it.
Apologies to Gar. Sometimes buried treasure isn't always lost forever. Sometimes it's lost to the IRS. There we go.
That is forever.
That would be forever, yep.
Isn't that just the most wonderful
Dale,
yodel you've ever heard?
It is. It's just so soothing. So soothing, except the Martians.
Yes.
We have one more bit here, and this is for 4th of July. And a wonderful thing, I know you love it, because Paul Harvey. And this is what Paul Harvey did on his radio show every 4th of July. And I'm pretty sure, because I have the actual vinyl recording of this. This is not that. I'm sure this is from one of his radio broadcasts. So that he redid this every year.
Okay.
It's about it should be under Paul Harvey, and it should be just before the on front of the parts.
I got
and,
it. All right.
And,
we got just enough time
yes.
for this bad boy. Let's get going.
Yep.
And we'll be right
Let's
back.
Let's get going.
Americans, the how and the why of our beloved republic are so much better known and understood than the who. The United States of America was born in 1776, but it was conceived 169 years before that. The earliest settlers had watered the New World with much sweat. They had built substantial holdings for themselves, for their families. And when the time came to separate themselves from a tyranny an ocean away, at best it meant starting all over again after the ravages of war. Researching what you're about to hear gave a whole new dimension to my reverence for our nation's first citizens. All others of the world's revolutions, before and since, were initiated by men who had nothing to lose. Nothing to lose. Our founders had everything to lose. And nothing to gain, except one thing. Hello, Americans, I'm Paul Harvey. You remember the cherry tree fiction. A long time after you have forgotten the more earth-shaking history-making episodes in the life of George Washington. You have misplaced in your memory the details of Ben Franklin's statesmanship, but you remember his flying a kite. Joyce Kilmer was a great military hero. But the only thing you personally recall about him is his poetic tribute to trees. Maybe of this current decade, that which will be remembered best will not be its wars and its moon rockets or its crumbling frontiers or the giants who lived and died. Maybe all that'll survive to linger in the day-by-day vocabulary of generations yet unborn may be the songs of a Memphis minstrel, or the reincarnation of electric automobiles. But for any eve of the 4th of July, I, Paul Harvey, do herewith bequeath unto you something to remember. You may not be able to quote one line from the Declaration of Independence at this moment. Henceforth, you'll always be able to quote at least one line. It's in the last paragraph where you will recall when I remind you, it says, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. In the Pennsylvania State House that's now called Independence Hall in Philadelphia, the best men from each of the colonies sat down together. This was a very fortunate hour in our nation's history, one of those rare occasions in the lives of men when we had greatness to spare. These were men of means, well-educated, 24 were lawyers and jurists, 9 were farmers, owners of large plantations. On June 11, a committee sat down to draw up a Declaration of Independence. We were going to tell the British fatherland, no more rule by redcoats. Below the dam of ruthless foreign rule, the stream of freedom was running shallow and muddy. And we were going to light a fuse to dynamite that dam. This pact, as Burke later put it, was a partnership between the living and the dead and the yet unborn. There was no bigotry, there was no demagoguery in this group. All had shared hardships. Jefferson finished a draft of the document in 17 days. Congress adopted it in July, and so much is familiar history. But now, King George III had denounced all rebels in America as traitors. Punishment for treason was hanging. The names now so familiar to you from the several signatures on that Declaration of Independence, the names were kept secret for 6 months. For each knew the full meaning of that magnificent last paragraph in which his signature pledged his life, his fortune, and his sacred honor. 56 men placed their names beneath that pledge. 56 men knew when they signed that they were risking everything. They knew if they won this fight, the best they could expect would be years of hardship in a struggling nation. And if they lost, they'd face a hangman's rope. But they signed the pledge. And here is the documented fate of that gallant 56. Carter Braxton of Virginia, wealthy planter, trader, saw his ships swept from the seas. To pay his debts, he lost his home and all of his properties and died in rags. Thomas Lynch, Jr., who signed that pledge, was a third-generation rice grower, aristocrat, large plantation owner. After he signed, his health failed. His wife and he set out for France to regain his failing health. Their ship never got to France, was never heard from again. Thomas McKean of Delaware was so harassed by the enemy that he was forced to move his family 5 times in 5 months. He served in Congress without pay, his family in poverty and in hiding. Vandals looted the properties of Ellery and Clymer and Hall and Gwinnett and Walton and Hayward and Rutledge and Middleton. Thomas Nelson, Jr. of Virginia, raised $2 million on his own signature to provision our allies, the French fleet. After the war, he personally paid back the loans, wiped out his entire estate, and he was never reimbursed by his government. In the final battle for Yorktown, he, Nelson, urged General Washington to fire on his, Nelson's, own home, which was occupied by Cornwallis. It was destroyed. Thomas Nelson, Jr. had pledged his life, his fortune, and his sacred honor. The Hessians seized the home of Francis Hopkinson of New Jersey. Francis Lewis had his home and everything destroyed, his wife imprisoned. She died within a few months. Richard Stockton, who signed that declaration, was captured, mistreated, his health broken to the extent that he died at 51. His estate was pillaged. Thomas Hayward, Jr. was captured when Charleston fell. John Hart was driven from his wife's bedside while she was dying. Their 13 children fled in all directions for their lives. His fields and grist mill were laid waste. For more than a year, he lived in forests and caves and returned home after the war to find his wife dead, his children gone, his properties gone. And he died a few weeks later of exhaustion and a broken heart. Lewis Morris saw his land destroyed, his family scattered. Philip Livingston died within a few months from the hardships of the war. John Hancock, history remembers best due to a quirk of fate rather than anything he stood for, that great sweeping signature attesting to his vanity, towers over the others, one of the wealthiest men in New England. And yet he stood outside Boston one terrible night of the war, and he said, "Burn Boston, though it makes John Hancock a beggar, if the public good requires it." So he, too, lived up to the pledge. Of the 56, few were long to survive. 5 were captured by the British and tortured before they died. 12 had their homes from Rhode Island to Charleston sacked, looted, occupied by the enemy, or burned. 2 lost their sons in the army. 1 had 2 sons captured. 9 of the 56 died in the war from its hardships or from its more merciful bullets. I don't know what impression you had of the men who met that summer in Philadelphia. But I think it's important that we remember this about them. They were not poor men. They were not wild-eyed pirates. These were men of means. They were rich men, most of them, and had enjoyed much ease and luxury in their personal living. Not hungry men, certainly not terrorists, not irresponsible malcontents, not fanatical incendiaries. These men were prosperous men, wealthy landowners. They were substantially secure in their prosperity. They had everything to lose. But they considered liberty, and this is as much as I shall say of it, they had learned that liberty is so much more important than security, that they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. And they fulfilled their pledge. They paid the price. And freedom was born.
Paul, we miss you.
We do. We do. Yeah. Used to listen to him every day in college, and if I didn't catch him in the morning, I caught him at the noon news, which was a lot longer than the morning 5 minutes that he did.
Yeah, I usually caught him at one point or another during a commute. Next week, we're heading out to the desert.
Yes, we are.
just in time for July, where it could be as hot as a desert. Yeah, we're going to have some Inner Sanctum, Mr. District Attorney, exploring tomorrow, and then CBS Radio Mystery Theater returns next Saturday with Secrets of the Aztecs.
Oh, that's another Percy Grainger story. That's why I thought we did, but we had not. So there we go.
There we go. That's next weekend. So now what? Oh, I don't know. Maybe after our show, you might want to sneak on over to Twitch and catch Garth with his program tonight.
Absolutely.
That'll be like and, right almost exactly when we're done.
And, of course, don't forget, we've got only about a month here to vote for the Horror Host Hall of Fame.
Yes.
And I am doing
my...
You will vote for Dave.
You will vote for Dave. You will vote for Dave.
I am getting at the Horror Host Hall of Fame at gmail.com. That's how you can just place your vote. Yes, as Dale does. The subliminal advertising.
Yes, my subliminal advertising.
Subliminal.
Yes.
Which is not so subliminal. But yeah, we're just really, it is an honor to be nominated. But it would be really cool to be there amongst my heroes and my idols, as well as, I look at it this way, Dale. Somebody's got to bring down that class a little bit. Might as well be me.
That's right. Who better? Who better? Now,
yep,
Dave, you are definitely one of the hardest working, and as I said in private earlier, you can stand toe-to-toe, and I've been around a lot of them, and you know it, and you can stand toe-to-toe with any of them, and you have worked with some of the greatest. That's all I got to say about that.
Well, in that case, it should be just about time to bring in the one and only Vincent. Should be just about around the corner here.
The castle lights are growing dim. There's no one left but me and him. When next we meet in Frankenstone, don't come alone.
And vote for Dave.
Good choices, Fogg.
So we were going to rush and do Boom Booms. The kids were coming tonight, but the plans have changed. Boom Booms will be tomorrow night.
Oh, Boom Booms will be tomorrow. Okay.
Yeah, Boom Booms tomorrow.
Okay. I think it was supposed to hold off.
Yep. And the little stinker went to the vet today. He's doing real good. Healthy. He's 24 pounds. He gained 7 pounds in 3 weeks.
Wow.
Oh, he's going to be a monster.
What are you feeding him? Miracle-Gro?
Yes. Actually. No, some kind of Nutrisource, I think. It's kind of expensive, but collies can have sensitive stomachs, so there's a few things. And then we always take this list the breeders made us take to the vet. Never give them these drugs, for different things. And some of them, depending on what it's for, like the heartworm stuff, they can have in a limited whatever. And collies are prone to eye problems. And he does have little leaky eyes, but not too bad. And he could grow out of it. So,
yeah.
Other than that,
okay.
He's in perfect health. Good. Good-looking dog.
Good. That's always good.
Yep.
We need some I voted stickers. That's what GC Side Paper just wrote down.
Yes. Oh, gosh. I saw those stickers in the cemetery. No, I'm kidding. Or am I?
I'm afraid to ask if you were kidding or not. So
yes, which is what I wanted.
always leave them wondering.
Some things, yeah. That's one thing I always heard. You know. Minimize your best stuff. You got to leave people wanting a little bit more. Like when I worked at the Marriott, they had a pretty good light system, and there were some effects that were rather dramatic, but you wanted to minimize using those because they lose their effect on if you overuse them.
Sure, yeah, that makes sense.
You know, you use the common stuff and blah blah blah. You know, just little lights jumping around in a pattern, but the really cool stuff, like they had this, I don't know, like stained glass dome over the dance floor, and it was lit from above. It was neat. It was really cool. That was probably the coolest place I worked, was Marriott on West 150th. It was called Shenanigans at the time.
Shenanigans, okay.
That was my most prestigious job. That's where I, you know, got to work for and or meet with some celebrities or quasi-celebrities, but most, and some real, you know, sports figures. People came in there to party after their whatever they did.
Yep.
That's fun.
Well, you know, even... You know, it's odd when you think about it. You know, most celebrities are fairly down to earth, especially for those that, you know, hang around other people who do what they do. You know,
yeah.
I even thought myself many times when I talk with some of the people I are friends with, you know, we talk about being on radio, on television and things like that. And it's not what you'd think that normal people talk about, but that's what we normally talk about. And I thought that once. I was talking to Diana. We were working on trying to do a radio gig. And we walked out. I said, do you realize that people overheard us, what we were talking about, how they just think we were both nuts? And we both had, you know, media experience, certainly, and stuff. So, but that's kind of stuff that we talk about. And so many celebrities, if they're just out with their other celebrity friends, they're just out there to have a good time, and
yeah.
Some involves talk, and some involves a little bit of maybe a drink and dance or whatever. But it's something that most people don't think about, because it's not something that they would ever think about talking about.
Yeah, true. True.
Well, sir, I wanted to try and get out there and try a little bit of yard work while we still have some daylight out here.
There's a wee
before
bit.
The boom booms happen.
Alrighty.
And I got a new lawnmower today. I got an electric lawnmower.
Oh.
And it took me 3 hours to charge it.
Don't mow on wet days.
No, that's yeah. But it is battery operated, the surprise how light it was that I realized, yeah, it's nearly all plastic. The heaviest thing on there is the battery I'm about to put in it, you know. So
yeah, I had one that had that you needed a cord for. My first home was a trailer, and so it was a very small yard. You know, you're done in seven minutes. You're done. But if it was really wet, I got zapped a few times. I don't think my plug was grounded very well.
I had a corded one myself, and the problem is upon occasion when you run over your own electric cord, which I did upon occasion.
Oh my God! No, I never did that. You post calls, but I've never done it. Oh, that can get ugly. But my son got me a good riding mower. I'm putting skulls and flames on it.
That's okay until you drive it down the road, you know. Then you're going to look for trouble.
No, I don't. I don't think I need to ride it down the road.
Ride it down to the neighborhood bar. Yeah.
Yeah. God, that would be fun. The Eagles Club across the street. There you go.
All right, sir. Well, with that, perhaps we can bring in the one and only Mr. James Durant. I will talk at you soon, and we'll see everybody on the radio before you know it.
That's right. Friday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern. We'll be back here. Bye-bye.
Good night. Good night. Good night.
Good night.
It's time to say good night.
Good night. Good night, then.
What more to say but good night?
Yes, there is more.
We've had a few laughs, and it's time for toodaloo. All right, go on, we the same, and you could think a do
good, be good,
good night. Good night. It's the road you
think. Good night, folks. And good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever.
Do you mind turning off the radio?
Missed me.